The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we're hearing the news from the Mobile World Congress currently underway in Barcelona. The latest headlines and the biggest trends are being beamed directly from the show floor. We also dissect the implications of Apple's threat to remove Eevee, a piece of voice recognition software that appeared to be in direct competition to the Apple Siri service. We find out more about the emails that hacker collective Anonymous delivered to whistleblowers WikiLeaks from the U.S. intelligence service Stratfor. And we speak with author Rebecca McKinnon about the other new sovereigns of cyberspace, Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Joining me down the line is Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. We'll have in-depth analysis of the latest headlines over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian, so do keep listening. It's the biggest event of the mobile calendar. The Mobile World Congress takes over the Catalan capital of Barcelona, and the faithful from around the globe descend in search of tapas and technology. And they are never left hungry. Past Mobile World Congresses have foreshadowed the demises of some of the market dominators and the rises of new major players. If 2011 was the year of the smartphone, what will 2012 hold? Joining us down the line is The Guardian's telecoms correspondent, Juliette Garside. Hello, Juliette. What does the floor look like this year?
Hi. Well, it's crazy as ever, very busy. A dramatic incident yesterday. The chief executive of Vodafone, Vitorio Colao, was rushed out of a meeting with journalists. We thought it was a bomb alert, and we got outside and we found the Vodafone stand was collapsing, and a forklift truck was quickly brought to prop it up again.
Oh, my goodness. I wonder, is that symbolic of Vodafone's standing at Mobile World?
If it doesn't sound too cliched, I think the mobile operators are feeling very vulnerable at the moment. These were great cash cow businesses during the 90s and the early part of this millennium. But their theme for this conference has been to push back against European regulators who every year enforce price cuts on the industry, and to push back against national governments which are auctioning off spectrum and hoping to raise billions from operators at a time when they're going to have to invest pretty heavily in building 4G mobile, superfast mobile broadband networks. So there was a meeting between the lead European telcos yesterday and European Competition Commissioner Neelie Kroes, where they argued for an end to enforced price cuts and threatened to withdraw investments effectively unless this happened. And the head of Telecom Italia was saying he's got $1 billion to invest this year and it's all going to Brazil, not a penny to Italy, because of heavy regulation. And meanwhile, the largest single pavilion here at the event is the Chinese company Huawei, which has specialized in building networks equipment, but has used Barcelona to launch a couple of gadgets, a smartphone and a tablet, and to state its aim of tripling sales to 60 million. And Samsung, of course, has had a triumphant 2011, becoming the world's largest smartphone maker. So the sun is rising in the east. And I think one of the big themes for this year is that handsets are starting to appear for Europe that will be ready for 4G when the networks here are up and running. We've had 4G-ready handsets from HTC, which has been left trailing along with LG and Sony by Samsung's success and is trying to make a bit of a comeback with its 1X range of Android-powered phones. And these also have quad-core processors. A lot of phones appearing with quad-core processors, just faster brains, essentially.
What is the timeline on the 4G spectrum in this country?
Well, in the UK, we're going to have an auction which will conclude, if all goes well and there are no further legal challenges, will conclude in the early part of 2013. And a national 4G network will not be ready to roll out until the end of 2013.
It sounds to me like there's a real shift of power that's happening in the industry, whether we're talking about the handset manufacturers, the networks, the operators, or even the regions from whence the technology and the systems are coming from.
So I think someone described Europe recently as a flyover zone for the mobile industry. The Europeans really created the mobile industry 15, 20 years ago by being clever and having all the European countries get together and create the GSMA standard, which then became the standard around the world. And off the back of that, they grew companies like Vodafone and Nokia. We've been behind on 4G, so it's already launched with handsets in America and it's launched in Singapore, for example. So these are becoming the breeding grounds for the powerful mobile companies of the future.
Well, speaking of Nokia, at last year's keynote by their fearless leader, Stephen Elop, he made a few waves by announcing that they were going to be abandoning their burning platform. How have they tried to recoup this year?
He was leading press conference yesterday saying that they've worked very fast. They've produced 4 new handsets since February last year, all running on the Windows Phone software. But he's still describing those handsets as a beachhead for future success. They haven't brought success in themselves. And we've got a redoubling of effort from companies like HTC and Samsung powering ahead. So Nokia's got a tough battle on its hands. Its unveilings at the conference this year were not that exciting. I mean, it's promising to bring its Lumia 900 4G handset, which launched in the United States, to Europe as and when networks are ready to use it. And it launched some cheaper Windows phones. And it also launched probably what will take the prize as the most bizarre phone launch of the event, with essentially it's a camera with a phone attached. It's a phone with a 41 megapixel camera. So by comparison, the iPhone 4S, which is considered to have a really good camera, has 8 megapixels. So this is a sort of professional quality resolution. But it runs on Symbian, which is the platform that was supposedly burning and that Nokia is abandoning. So I think it's just a bit of a gimmick.
Tonight, Google's chairman, Eric Schmidt, is taking the stage for a keynote. What do you expect?
I think that he'll be talking about increased activation for Android, which Google announced yesterday have reached 850,000. I think they want to really push into tablet computers this year. They've sold 12 million so far. I think Apple have sold 50 million, and there's room to gain ground there. They've been emphasizing that the deal to acquire Motorola, will not affect their neutral stance, that they want to continue producing Hero devices with other manufacturers as well. They've worked with HTC and Samsung in the past, and they're reiterating at this conference that they want to carry on doing that.
I mean, basically, given that Motorola is a dog of a business in its handset business, it's a constant money loser. It sounds like it's just being taken out on the mountain road and left to die. But just rewinding, Julia, I mean, the thing with all the quad-core smartphones, what actually is there that anyone wants to do? You know, what is it that quad-core smartphones are going to do which you couldn't do with a dual core? Is there actually the demand there? Because the suggestions I've seen is that it could start chewing up your battery life, they could be pricey. I'm not quite sure that I've seen anyone who said, you know, I really wish that my phone was faster so that, you know, I could do it.
Well, I had a demonstration yesterday of the HTC One X, and they were showing how the camera effectively did a lot of photoshopping itself. So it could take a photo into direct sunlight, and what it did to make that look good at the end of it was effectively take 3 photos, merge them, and then create a JPEG. So I guess things like that can happen very quickly at the touch of a button. Perhaps it lets you carry more apps.
Finally, Juliet, where are the other two companies that we've been speaking a lot about this year, RIM and Apple? How are they represented?
Well, Apple never come. I think they send their executives along, but they never take a stand. RIM have been fairly quiet. I mean, they haven't got a commercial launch of their new software yet to show off. And they've produced one small initiative which reinforces their stance as operator-friendly. They've pre-installed operator billing for buying apps off a BlackBerry smartphone, but I don't know how many apps you'd want to buy on a BlackBerry smartphone at this stage.
Well, thank you very much, Juliet. I'm afraid that's all we have time for at the minute. Enjoy the tapas.
Thank you very much. I will do. And the sangria.
And you can follow the events live at guardian.co.uk/technology. Speaking of Apple, the company rocked a few boats this week by threatening to remove Eevee, a British-developed voice recognition service that is similar to the US manufacturer's own voice recognition service, Siri. Charles, what's the story here?
Well, Eevee is an app which is developed by a company called True Knowledge. It's a Cambridge-based company, and it does speech analysis. So you say things to it, it figures out what the words are that you said, turns it into text, and then goes and looks it up against a giant database that it has, or else does a web search or a map search. Although it's not as integrated as the Apple Siri function is. So, for example, it can't give you reminders, it can't change your calendar, It can do things like answering simple questions, and you can also put in text questions if you prefer. It's available both on Apple's App Store and on the Android platform. Interestingly, on the Apple Store, it costs 69p, which, as I understand it from William Tunstall-Peter, who's the chief executive of True Knowledge, it's because they have to pay Nuance, the same speech recognition company that Apple uses, they have to pay them on the Apple side to get the translation done, whereas on the Android side, it's all done through Google's voice recognition service, so there it's free. And what happened is that they got a call on Friday saying that the app was going to be pulled from the store imminently. Things went a bit quiet then, and the story got to TechCrunch. Then Apple seemed to relent and has since been reconsidering. And my understanding now is that True Knowledge has been told that if it can change the interface, then things will be okay for the app.
So change the interface from a voice-based interface, which is the killer app
no,
of the app.
No, it's not about being voice-based. It might be things to do with either using speech bubbles or the sort of conversation flow that it shows, or probably that it uses a circular icon, rather like the Siri one, though. It doesn't have a microphone, it has a sort of cyclops in it. So it's no one quite knows what it is that Apple doesn't like. Well, possibly someone on Apple does, but they're not saying. All they know is that they have to tweak it somehow.
What about the free market? What about this idea that there's competition and that the App Store is full of content, of apps that do similar things? What's the problem here?
Well, Apple has one of the clauses in its terms and conditions is that things mustn't appear to mimic Apple services. As far as the competition question goes, people say, well, surely this is it's like Microsoft and the browser. Got to give people a history lesson here. Microsoft had 95% plus of the PC market, and what it got caned for in the US as well as Europe was the fact that it told companies, either you use our browser as your default browser rather than Netscape, or we won't allow you to have Windows. Apple doesn't have a dominant share of the smartphone market. It's somewhere around 20%, 25%, 30%. Android is the one that dominates, but Google allows anyone to put stuff on its App Store. So there's no dominant player in the smartphone market unless you want to say that it's Android. So if Apple chooses to remove things at a whim from the Apple Store, the App Store, then actually, there's not that strong a case to complain about competition if you're able to put it on other app stores.
And so, therefore, Apple has to be referred to or at least considered a benevolent dictator if you want to access that market.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's sort of, it's their football field and they get to decide who plays on it. But, other football fields are available. It might seem a bit bizarre because, lots of people think that Apple is the smartphone market, but, just isn't the case. Symbian is still, selling out there. Windows Phone is starting to get a little bit of traction, but it's very much Apple and Android, and a lot of it is down to Android.
Well, the history of this is all covered in your book, Charles, Digital Wars. Nice little plug there. Thank you very much. I expect my commission in the post. But briefly, taking a look actually at the application, what does Evie do that Siri doesn't? Because if it is just a like for like, then you can understand how it would break the terms and conditions.
Well, the thing that Evie does do, which Siri doesn't do in the UK at the present, is it can do things like local search. It can try to find your restaurants in your vicinity, do maps in the UK, which Siri doesn't do in the UK at the moment. That's limited to the US, so that's the principal benefit that Evie has. Plus there's a sort of quite interesting interface system for doing your queries. You don't necessarily have to use voice, you can do it with typing.
For more on the power that corporations have over our online experiences, do keep listening to Tech Weekly, as later in the podcast we'll hear from Rebecca McKinnon about the role that Apple, Google, and Facebook play in how we navigate the web. So the collective known as Anonymous has hacked into the email servers of the global intelligence firm Stratfor and has delivered 5.5 million emails to whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks has begun publishing them, starting with a tranche of 167 emails. We're joined in the studio by James Ball, one of The Guardian's data journalists who's specifically working on the investigations team. James, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there.
Tell me a little bit about what the emails tell us.
I think they probably tell us a bit less than WikiLeaks thought they did. Like anyone else, these private intelligence companies are prone to gossip and occasionally a bit of showing off as well. So there's lots of really juicy little tidbits. There's suggestions that McCain could have taken legal action about election fraud against President Obama. WikiLeaks thinks there's things in there showing insider dealing and all of this sort of stuff. But while there's lots of quite interesting tidbits, especially if you like the online world of security, it's actually a lot of it's just gossip. You know, Stratfor is described as the shadow CIA, a private sector CIA. It's sometimes seems a little bit more like a private sector Keystone Cops.
And so a lot of the information that appears to have come to light doesn't have a lot of evidence to back it up. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's just it. I mean, essentially, there's lots of tantalizing little bits in there, but anyone can sort of say something interesting. It's always about assessing how much seems to be behind it. And in some cases, there's got to be some good leads in here, but anything related to Intel, even the State Department dump, is gossip. But sometimes it's just interesting to know what an organization's gossiping about. When it's the State Department of the most powerful country in the world, then we're going to care, really, whether they're right or wrong. Just that they think that is kind of interesting. For these guys, is it quite as relevant to us? I'm not sure it is. It's interesting, but it's not earth-shattering.
It's the Heat magazine of the intelligence circuit.
It's kind of like Heat magazine for web nerds. Yeah, I like that.
To what degree would you say that WikiLeaks is interested because there's a lot of chatter on these emails about WikiLeaks?
Well, I'm sure it's never been said that Julian's the shy retiring type. It's, I think anything with WikiLeaks that makes WikiLeaks look big and important is got to count there. But, I mean, WikiLeaks didn't select this material. It was passed to them by someone else. And so, really, it's more about what Anonymous, who got it for them, thought it might have in it.
This is an interesting alliance, isn't it? You've got arguably an illegal hacker collective doing illegal stuff, delivering stuff to an organization that has an agenda, has a very particular agenda about openness. What do you think are the implications in the long term for these types of alliances, these types of allegiances?
I think probably certain groups in the US are cheering. It's like there's suddenly a new online axis of evil, all the various bad guys on the internet for people who see the web a certain way are teaming up together. It's that's probably quite a nice thing if you're trying to look for ways to stop them. But it's not a bad fit, Anonymous and WikiLeaks. You know, WikiLeaks has its sort of hacktivist roots. Anonymous, these days, since it's not the same thing it used to be when it was 4chan and just trolling internet forums, they get on. They have a similar kind of ideology and they're all concerned about security firms and spying and all of this stuff. So it's kind of an obvious fit, but it's a big step for WikiLeaks. The previous stuff that we all know it for came from leaks. It was, you know, the idea of this principled insider. This is definitely really the result of a hack. It's much more the result of people deliberately breaking into systems or this kind of bad activity, if you want to see it that way. And so WikiLeaks has sort of taken a bit of a side jump there. And I think there's people who can defend leaks who probably can't defend hacks. So,
Charles, having been close to and covered Anonymous and various other hacker collectives, what do you see as the implications for this relationship? Are WikiLeaks benefiting more than Anonymous? Are Anonymous benefiting from this relationship more than WikiLeaks?
I think that Anonymous wants to have some sort of way of getting things out, and it's never really found a very effective way before. The whole process of having to sift through emails is really hard work, and so, you know, being able to pass it on to WikiLeaks, in effect just hand it off, makes the process much simpler. So Anonymous can sort of get on, it's almost like outsourcing it, is it? Anonymous can get on with the tough work of hacking into systems, and then it can pass it off to WikiLeaks, who can do the hard work, quotes, of distributing it and getting the attention of the world's media. But whether there's quite the quality control that you would get when you had The Guardian, New York Times, Washington Post, German papers and so on, all involved in actually looking at things and making sure that the release of data wouldn't lead to any direct harm, it's slightly different. Doing this isn't necessarily going to bring the greatest benefit to the greatest number of people, I don't think. And I mean, I have to think also that there's this sort of great desire to see the world in black and white, that everyone wears either a white hat or a black hat, you know, that either security firms are totally evil or else they're, you know, completely on your side. And the world just doesn't work that way.
Finally, in the news this week, East Africa's high-speed broadband was disrupted after an anchor was dropped on one of the undersea cables that connects that part of the continent with the rest of the world. The ship dropped its anchor on one of the new cables, which was landed in 2009, as it awaited docking outside of Mombasa. According to reports, it could take up to a fortnight for the cable to be fully fixed, disrupting high-speed access in many parts of the continent. Now, Charles, how actually will this affect this part of Africa's high-speed broadband network?
Well, if you go to submarinecablemap.com, then you can actually see an interactive map of all of the undersea cables around the world. And what it shows is that for the east coast of Africa, with landfall on Mombasa, you've got three different cables coming in from three different companies. The one that's been hit is one by a company called Teams, but there are two other cables which make landfall there. Now, those aren't as new and they aren't as fast, so this will mean that, as much as anything, the sort of bandwidth that's available in the east of Africa will be severely limited for a burgeoning economy with the internet trying to take off there. It is a problem, but it's not as if they've been plunged into a sort of internet darkness completely.
How many cables connect the UK with the rest of the world?
There's about 40 looking at the map, though I suspect there are probably more than that which aren't shown, either because they're military or other security purposes. But they're spread all around the UK, and there are some in Scotland, there are some on the east, there are some linking to Ireland, there are some down by Cornwall, a very famous one which makes landfall in Cornwall. So this sort of thing couldn't really happen in the UK. You couldn't really disrupt the whole of the internet by whacking an anchor onto one of these cables.
How often does this kind of thing happen, though?
Well, we had it happen in Egypt a couple of years ago. Our regular listeners will remember back in the days when Bobby Johnson was on the podcast, that we had precisely this happening with for pretty much precisely the same reason. So ships and anchors is the sort of marine equivalent of fairly careless workers with diggers who from time to time will dig up important cables. It's basically a hazard of how the whole thing works.
Although these have ostensibly been accidents, and it's not possible to break the internet completely because people can always root around issues. Actions against the physical infrastructure of the net, like these cables, could be an interesting protest move. Have we seen any indication that this could be in the future?
It's generally far easier to cut off the internet by going to internet service providers. That's the sort of thing that governments who want to restrict communication in this way, that's how they go about it. I mean, blowing up fuel lines is one thing, and that's a fairly common sort of tactic in wars. But the thing is always that with the internet, people can have sat phones, they can get around that sort of thing in other ways. So as a tactic in, you know, war or conflict, cutting internet cables actually isn't a very useful one, because, you know, they can be used for either side, and actually you might come back and find that you want to have your internet hooked up.
Thanks very much, Charles. And you can read up on the rest of this week's stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. In her new book, Consent of the Network, journalist and researcher Rebecca McKinnon paints a picture of the negotiations of power between three poles of the internet experience: corporations like Apple, Google, and Facebook, sovereign governments, and the people who have access to and use the web to disrupt and cause revolution. Compelling storytelling. I spoke with Rebecca about this power play and began by asking what's changed from the optimistic early days of the web to the current pessimism that she discusses now.
Well, you know, a lot more people are using it for a lot more things than originally. And I think what we've seen in the past decade is that governments like the Chinese government, for instance, have proven that an authoritarian government can adapt to the internet and survive. And you've also seen, you know, Evgeny Morozov had a book that came out last year that talked a lot about kind of the dark side of the internet and sort of the bad people who use it and the repressive regimes that are as empowered sometimes by the technology as the activists and you know, what we would call the good guys. but what I actually argue in the book is that, you know, we can argue endlessly over whether the internet empowers the good guys more than the bad guys, whether it's making us smarter or stupider. But ultimately, I think the more urgent and important question is, how do we ensure that it evolves in a manner that remains compatible with democracy, compatible with human rights, and compatible with the kind of political society that we want to have, the political rights that in the UK and the United States we're always striving to improve upon, but that people around the world are risking their lives for every day, and sometimes using the internet to help themselves do it. But how do we ensure that people can continue to use the internet for dissent, that anonymity will remain possible for the vulnerable, things like that?
Well, then there's been a lot of cultural shifts, and you mentioned anonymity at the end. There's a real move at the moment to de-anonymize the web with you know, networks like Facebook and to an extent things like Google Plus. Mm-hmm. How can we and why should we protect anonymity?
If you're going to have a democracy as opposed to a tyranny of the majority, vulnerable people, people who are unpopular, minority speech needs to have a place. If it's squeezed off the internet because the risk becomes too high to engage in controversial speech, unpopular speech, or for people who are physically vulnerable to the consequences of their speech to use the internet, we're not going to have a democracy anymore. We're going to have a tyranny of the majority. And so, you know, you're seeing, on the one hand, companies like Facebook in particular, where Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO's ideology is really that we need to all be open and connected, and we need to be honest about who we are online. And that's well and good if you're in a society where bad things don't happen to unpopular people or vulnerable minorities. But, you know, what about the person, let's say, who's a victim of spousal abuse? You know, let's not talk about the dissident in Syria, but let's talk about in the UK, the victim of spousal abuse who wants to be involved with a movement to improve the laws around protecting victims of domestic violence. And will this person be able to use the internet to do so or not depends on whether there's some kind of protection of this person's privacy and identity in the digital services and platforms that they depend upon.
But doesn't this focus, this sort of shift towards de-anonymization, reflect a cultural desire for identifiability? Doesn't it sort of solve the problem that we're concerned with about identifiability?
Well, there's a lot of pressure towards de-anonymization, certainly. One reason just has to do with holding people accountable for bad behavior. And there's a serious problem with bad behavior online and criminal behavior and so on. And if you get rid of anonymity, if you make everybody trackable to their physical identity, the argument is that not only can you stop bad behavior, but you can fight crime more effectively. The problem is that just as, you know, in the real world, you can have an absolute solution, but is that a solution that's compatible with the rights not only of the majority, but of the minority? And that's the problem. I think, you know, for the average person to say, I have nothing to hide, you know, the only people who have something to worry about are the people who are doing something bad, that's not a democracy. These large global corporations, it's a double-edged thing. So on the one hand, people who use Facebook around the world is sort of this global constituency. So Facebook and the Facebook user community are using the internet, using social media to challenge state power. But also the decisions that Facebook makes about your privacy, about your identity, then interact with state power in ways that oftentimes I think the engineers in Palo Alto and the managers there haven't thought about. You know, when you change suddenly your privacy settings so that people's friends' networks are suddenly exposed, or certain postings that used to by default be private suddenly become more public, what does that mean for people whose life may be depending on certain relationships remaining hidden? That's something that companies aren't thinking about, yet they're making these decisions that shape our online identities, shape our relationships online, and shape what we know, you know, what we can discover. And again, you know, sometimes they're positive and quite empowering, but sometimes they're not. And the question is, Do companies need to be held more accountable to the public interest?
Some people describe people like Mark Zuckerberg and Larry and Sergey from Google as benign dictators. You know, these individuals who do hold the power, but they are still beholden to the governments and the jurisdictions in which they operate. Google in China is a classic example from the beginning of 2011, basically when Google said that they would pull out of mainland China. So there is this really interesting power dynamic that is occurring. Mm-hmm. Who would you say at the moment holds the power in the digital world?
I would say it really varies on the situation, you know, and this is why in the United States, for instance, with the Stop Online Piracy Act, where the U.S. Congress, SOPA, where the U.S. Congress was trying to, or parts of the U.S. Congress were seeking to pass this law that would really affect how Google and Facebook work. And this is where you get kind of a sovereignty mismatch because, you know, they're based in the United States. They, you know, the Congress does have a really big influence on how they operate and then how people all over the world use their service. But, you know, all these users all over the world have no way of holding the U.S. Congress accountable for doing something that might hurt their ability to use these networks or their ability to speak freely online. And so you have this kind of mismatch where power that is supposed to be exercised just within one jurisdiction, kind of through these networks, goes global in ways that, again, can sometimes be positive when you have, for instance, if you have a good set of privacy laws that might be passed in one jurisdiction that might end up turning into a norm for the industry. So sometimes it has positive effect. But then at the same time, you know, increasingly, politicians around the world are dependent on Facebook to get reelected. You know, so there's this symbiotic dependency that's also developing. Certainly in the United States, the strategy, Facebook's strategy is get them all dependent on Facebook and they'll regulate us less. And also as campaigns increasingly become dependent on these social networks to get out the vote, to get garner support, it's kind of a feedback loop of each empowering the other in ways that if that relationship is not transparent, can potentially be quite troubling.
Where does the individual fit into all of this? Because at the moment, we're just speaking about corporates versus government.
Yeah. Well, the individual fits in quite a number of ways, you know, as users, as consumers, as voters, as employees of companies, you know, media and technology companies and so on, making decisions about how a service should operate, as in many cases, activists. You know, there are many ways that we can kind of take ownership and responsibility for how this network is being shaped, you know, the way in which we use it, but also the way in which we exercise our power over those who have power. We do have some leverage over regulators. We have some leverage over these companies, you know, so it's kind of incumbent on us to make it clear to these companies that if they do not earn our trust, if they do not act in a way that is compatible with the kind of political society we'd like to have and our, you know, our rights, our civil liberties, in addition to our entertainment and our delight and our convenience, that there will be consequences.
I don't see that happening, though, with something like a Facebook. We do occasionally see flare-ups against the privacy issues, but then they seem to dissipate.
Yeah.
It becomes normative. To what extent are individuals actually engaging with some of these deeper questions?
Well, you know, I think we're kind of right now, to draw an analogy with the environmental movement, it's 1970 Earth Day. People are just waking up to these issues and how they affect us personally. You know, I think up until recently, these issues have really been a province of a smaller segment of society, you know, people who are kind of specialized or particularly obsessed or concerned. And I think it's broadening it out. And I think society at large, because of the SOPA thing in the United States, because of the ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Act, that's, you know, being signed by governments across Europe and people protesting. And I think people, you know, pirate parties getting elected here and there, green parties taking on anti-surveillance, anti-censorship as part of their platform. I think it's sort of a new generation of activism becoming aware of a whole new space that requires holding companies and government accountable. And just as sort of a generation ago, you had the Greens coming on and you had environmental issues becoming mainstream political issues, mainstream consumer issues, the mainstream investor issues now. But they weren't you know, a few decades ago. And people were like, oh, you'll never, you know, Milton Friedman, the economist, was writing essays about how, you know, the only thing that companies should be held responsible for is making profits and everything else is rubbish. And that's no longer the social norm. That is no longer the social expectation or the market's expectation, frankly. And I think we're at the early stages of the same thing happening with the internet, with our digital rights, with our digital civil liberties, that people are starting to wake up and recognize that if we don't engage, you're not going to get companies or governments to do the right thing unless you have a movement. And, you know, several decades ago, there wasn't much of an environmental movement. We now have one. So I think it's possible. Does it take a lot of effort? Sure.
Last question. What would you advise Mark Zuckerberg?
I would ask him to make it possible for people to use pseudonyms. I would ask him to conduct human rights assessments in thinking about new policies and products, in planning them. I would ask him to join the Global Network Initiative and make a commitment to uphold core principles on free expression and privacy. I would ask him to recognize that he is not God, that he does not have all the answers, and that a wise sovereign understands that you gain legitimacy by sharing power with those you govern and empowering them and involving them in where things are going. And I think that is as true for the success of his type of business going forward as it is for our lives in physical space.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebecca McKinnon, author of Consent of the Networked, out now and available at guardian.co.uk/books. That's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to Charles, James, Juliet, and Rebecca McKinnon. Next week, Charles interviews Vivian Redding, the Vice President and Commissioner responsible for Justice, Fundamental Rights, and Citizenship at the European Commission. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch, head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all the social and the anti-social options, including links to our Facebook and Twitter pages and our email address, and do leave comments on the blog. The producer this week was Ian Chambers. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we are back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.